submit any spaces for the people who run it. What is that? Someone's mobile phone ring or what? Huh? Hare Krishna. Swagatam. 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 Om Jirachanam. Chamyananda Chaganajana Salataya. Saksir Samaritan Vena Tasmai Sri Hiradayanama. Sri Chaitanya Manavishtam Stapitam Jaina Bhutale Sayam Vipakadamayam Adati Swapanantikam. This is, we'll read the final chapter of the 10th canto. It's entitled The Summary of Lord Krishna's Glories. Quite interesting. It has some of the most some verses that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu described as especially wonderful. Some of them are a little intimate here. Start reading in the middle of the chapter. There are 50 verses, and it's describing the relationship of the queens. Or how Krishna enjoyed his existence in Dwarka. I'll first read the first 7 verses. They're in one sequence. Sukadeva Goswami said, "The master of the goddess of fortune resided happily in his capital city of Dwarka." Have you been to Dwarka? Have you? Have you? Yes? You have been? Very, very sweet there. There's one river called Gomti that it comes up and down. It disappears very shallow and sometimes very full of water. So he lived happily in his capital city of Dwarka, which was endowed with all opulences and populated by the most eminent rishis and their gorgeously dressed wives. When these beautiful women in the bloom of youth would play on the city's rooftops with balls and other toys, they shone like flashing lightning. The main streets of the city were always crowded with intoxicated elephants, exuding mada, and also with cavalry, richly adorned infantrymen, and soldiers riding chariots brilliantly decorated with gold. Gracing the city were many gardens and parks with rows of flowering trees, where bees and birds would gather, filling all directions with their songs. Madhruv, in Dwarka there is no kangaroo. No, in Dwarka, no kangaroo. Lord Krishna was the sole beloved of his only beloved of his 16,000 wives. Expanding himself into that many forms, Krishna enjoyed with each of his queens in her own richly furnished residence. On the grounds of these palaces were clear ponds, fragrant with the pollen of blooming utpal, kalar, kumud, and ambosia lotuses, and filled with flocks of cooing birds. So everything was very, very sweet, auspicious, and very delicate and wonderful. And it was all meant for Krishna's pleasure, and pleasure of Krishna's dear ones. The Almighty Lord would enter those ponds and also various rivers, and enjoyed sporting in the water while his wives embraced him, leaving the red kumkum from their bodies smeared on his body. So there's a description of the atmosphere and the dealings between the Krishna and his queens and Dwarka. Afterwards, Lord Krishna and his wives would give the ornaments and clothing they had worn during their water sports to the male and female performers, who earned their livelihood from singing and from playing musical instruments. In this way, Krishna would sport with his queens, totally captivating their hearts with his gestures, his talks, his glances, his smiles, and also with his jokes, his playful exchanges and embraces. The queens would become stunned in ecstatic trance. Their minds were absorbed in Krishna alone. Then, thinking of their lotus-eyed Lord, they would speak as if they were insane. Please hear these words from me as I relate them. Purport. Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur explains that this superficial appearance of insanity in Lord Krishna's queens, as if they had become intoxicated by datura or some other drug, was in fact the manifestation of the sixth progressive stage of pure love of God, technically known as Prema Vaichitya. Srila Rupa Goswami refers to this variety of anurag. So anurag is the stage before Bhava and Prema in Mahabhava on the level of Prema. So this has nothing to do with the material world. Actually, it's a stage of ecstasy that the queens realized in their loving relationship with Krishna. So this is quite similar to the things that happen to the Braja Gopis. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu used to chant, especially the next verse. He used to like this next verse very much. So Rupa Goswami refers to this variety of anurag bhava and prem, in Ujjana Lamani 15.134. Priyasya sannikarshepi premotkarsha swabhavataha yad vishlesha diyartistat prema vachitra uchate. So this is the definition that Rupa Goswami gives of prema vachitya. When, as a natural byproduct of one's extreme love, one feels the distress of separation, even in the direct presence of the beloved, this state is called prema vaichitya. So this means that even when one is with Krishna, the queens are with Krishna, and this also happened in Prem Sarova, in Vrindavan, in Nandagam, when Srimati Radharani was with Krishna. The feeling of separation while you're in the presence of the Lord, therefore it's called a type of insanity. So Mahishi Uchu, so the queen said in this verse, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, you quoted this verse, you used to say it. The queen said, O Karari bird, and I'm not sure what kind of a bird a Karari bird, a female osprey. I've never heard the singing of a Karari bird. O Karari bird, you are lamenting. Now it is night, and somewhere in this world, the Supreme Lord is asleep in a hidden place. But you are wide awake, O friend, unable to fall asleep. Is it that you, like us, you have had your heart pierced to the core by the lotus-eyed Lord's munificent, playful, smiling glances? So the queens were up, Krishna was resting alongside them, and the queens would be up in their loving ecstasy. They would be missing Krishna and feeling separation from him even while he was sleeping right by their side. So they would hear this Karari bird singing in the middle of the night, and they would identify the type of singing that the Karari bird doing, the female Karari bird is doing, is like their own thoughts. So they're saying, you can't sleep at night. What is the proof that you can't sleep at night? That you're singing. So you have a very sad type of song that you're singing. Could it be that you are wide awake, O friend? You're unable to fall asleep because you have had your heart pierced to the core by the lotus-eyed Lord's munificent, generous, playful, smiling glances. So this was their situation, and this is a characteristic of Uttama, the highest Uttama Bhagavat, the highest devotee, is that they see everywhere they look, they see everyone else in love with Krishna. They see that every action that everyone else performs, they see the symptom of that person or that animal or that bird or that tree's love for Krishna, and they think, I'm the only one who doesn't love Krishna. So they're thinking of, so the queens are up at night, they couldn't sleep at night worrying, oh, Krishna's not, he's not going to be here, he's going to leave the next day, because they were so much captivated in love with Krishna, their mind was fully absorbed in Krishna in the greatest ecstatic love. So here's the purport of the Srinath Chakravarti Thakura. See, the Vishnath Chakravarti, excuse me, of the BBT purport, describing about Vishnath Chakravarti Thakura's coming. Srila Vishnath Chakravarti Thakura explains that the transcendental madness, unmad, of the queens filled them with such ecstasy that they saw their own mood reflected in everyone and everything else. Here they point out to the Karari bird, whom they take to be sorrowing over separation from Lord Krishna, that if the Lord actually had any concern for her or themselves, he would not be sleeping comfortably at that moment. They warn the Karari not to expect Krishna to hear her lamentation and show some mercy. In case the Karari might think that Krishna is sleeping with his queens, they deny this by saying that he is Gupta Bodha. His whereabouts are unknown to them. He is out of the world somewhere this night, out in the world somewhere this night, but they have no idea where to go looking for him. Ah, dear birds, they cried, even though you are a simple creature, your heart has been deeply pierced, just like ours. You must have had some contact then with our Krishna. What keeps you from giving up your hopeless attachment to him? So this was their own mood, the intensity of love. This, of course, how can we understand what this is like? In this world, it is very hard to even know what love is, even in this world. So, so if we take the love of this world and multiply it by 1,000,000,000, and then multiply it again by 1,000,000,000,000, and then multiply that again by 100,000,000,000, and then multiply that again by 100,000,000,000, then we have no idea of, we have some idea of what a drop is in the ocean of love for Krishna. What to speak of, what the queens are experiencing, what to think of, what the gopis experience, and what's the difference between the queens and the gopis. The queens are known as sambandamayi, and the gopis are known as sambandatmika, and the gopis are kamatmika. So the queens, they love Krishna so dearly, and their love is all in madhurya ras, in the conjugal mellow, but they have something in the relationship. They have their relationship, their sambandha is fixed. They have him, they are married to him. But the gopis, they are just called kamatmika. They don't even have that. They don't even demand that in a relationship with Krishna. They just want to give everything to Krishna. So this mood of the queens, but especially the Braja Gopis, is the topmost, most intimate type of absorption in loving sentiments to Krishna. So therefore, in that sense, it includes everything else. And therefore, because their love is more complete, therefore their ecstasy is the highest. But how can we understand what it is like? We cannot. Rupa Goswami, in Lecture Devotion Bhaktivinoda Sindhu, he says that if you take the happiness of this world, or he says the happiness of Brahman is so far above any happiness in this world. Even the happiness of going to Swargaloka is so far above the happiness of this world. And it is of a different caliber. It's on a different level. It's not that you get more of the same. Like here, you get veggie burgers and chips. So there you get more, and you can eat more, and they taste even better to you. It's not like that. It's on a completely different level than Swargaloka, because the consciousness of the people is more subtle. So the pleasure is more subtle. The happiness is more subtle. So similarly, so what it is like there and the kind of happiness they enjoy there is very, we can't understand. It's like if we have gross taste buds in our tongue. We taste something and we don't really taste anything, but there are gourmets. People are very subtle. Like Korma Prabhu was like that. He can just taste something and he can tell you exactly what ingredients are in it just from tasting. Just he knows immediately. And Tamal Krishnamaraj, he was really, he could not like that, but he had very, very subtle tastes. And Prabhupada, of course, can easily tell the different qualities of eating. Or someone gets some pleasure from listening to music. So some person goes to heavy metal rock concerts, and the music is so loud that a normal person, they're like this, and it's just very, very heavy and really tamaguni and rajaguni, and he's enjoying. But then there's a person who prefers music, the subtleties and studied music. He knows the subtleties of the music of the symphonic orchestra and how the different parts fit together. So both of them are enjoying the heavy metal loud music player with us. We used to, when we were living in Bayswater, they used to have that, what was it called, the Big Day Out or something? So that night, and the place where they would have the concert, the rock concert, was kilometers away, and you could still, it was so loud, you could hear it, it would keep you up all night. It was so loud, kilometers away. So gross, not fine at all. But then there's subtle type of enjoyments. But you have to have a subtle, very refined taste, otherwise it appears boring. And it's true in art, it's true in music, anything fine, it's true in cooking and taste, it's true in everything, and everything fine in this world. There's different levels of enjoyment, and that's in this world. So in Swargaloka, there's a completely different level of enjoyment. Subtle, fine. The consciousnesses are different. And then in Brahmaloka, also called Satyaloka, it's completely different again. It's so fine and so subtle. And none of the enjoyments in this world can compare to the bliss of Brahman. And then if you take the bliss of Brahman and multiply it by a million and a trillion, that's like the smallest drop in the ocean of bhava, which is a drop of the ocean of prema, something like that. So what can we understand of what it's like, of what's going on here? Because we can think, oh, I know what this is like. It's just like the rock concert with the loud music. on, and they're enjoying that, but it's nothing to do with the tastes of this world. It has to do with the soul's ecstatic, loving relationship with Krishna. It's based on that taste, that sweetness. Nothing to do with the material energy whatsoever. So they're experiencing it, the most fine, most subtle, all based on nothing to do with passion, nothing to do with ignorance, and this is how subtlety and grossness is calculated in terms of ignorance is the most gross. And there are people who get pleasure in ignorance, and they're drinking, and they're falling in the street even, screaming, and they think it's really, and they're getting pleasure in that way. And a person who's not intoxicated thinks these people are crazy and are fools, but they're getting pleasure, but it's so gross. And if you walk past in the United States, they call them bars, and in Australia, they call them pubs, and in India, they don't even have them. They call them clubs, maybe, something. They have clubs in Bombay? Yes, they have clubs.
Many is growing.
Huh?
Many is growing.
Yeah, because everyone is going. Their pleasure is coming more from the mode of tamagun. But you walk past these places, and the atmosphere is dark, and the smell of all the horrible rotting liquor, and the smoke coming out, and you can feel this, like the tamagun just like pouring out of it, and it's actually so repulsive. But if you have that taste for tamagun, then this is pleasure. And certainly the reason why it's growing isn't because it's unpopular, it's growing because people have getting that taste more and more and more. But this is subtle, the most subtle. Not tamagun, not rajagun, and not even the sattvagun of this world, because the sattvagun of this world is tinged always with rajagun and tamagun. But shuddha sattva, it's of a different nature. The sattvagun in this world is a reflection, a shadow of the Sudha Sattva, the pure goodness of the spiritual world. So what is being experienced? This whole tenth canto is describing the experiences of those qualified persons who are so qualified that they can relate with Krishna, just like Prabhupada would give the example, the Sanskrit word is tadatmika. Means tadiyanam samacharam, means like just like fire. Say there's a blazing fire, and sometimes when it gets very cold, but there still was some kind of a fire going on in here. But there's a fire over here. Say if we had the fireplace going on here, so the room would get warm, but you couldn't stay very close to the fire. What to speak of, put your hand in the fire, because there's an incompatibility between what our hand is composed of and what the fire is composed of. Our hand is composed of earth, water, etc., flesh, blood, and the fire is composed of fire. So to approach the fire, one has to be fire. So to approach the spiritual realm, one has to be no rajagun, no tamagun, and even beyond the sattvagun of this world. But the sattvagun of this world is like a jumping off position. From that we can jump to the spiritual platform more easily, or we can make our attempts. So the queens were lamenting. Here's the second verse of their lamentation as they were staying up all night, missing Krishna in the mood of prema vaichitya, missing Krishna, but he's right there with them. And they're thinking he's not there, but he is there. They say, poor Chakravaki, even after closing your eyes, you continue to cry pitifully throughout the night for your unseen mate. Or is it that you, like us, have become the servant of Achyuta and hanker to wear in your braided hair the garland he has blessed with the touch of his feet? So they're seeing everything and hearing everything. It's like we see everything according to our own minds. They're seeing everything according to their minds. And this is actually a hard point to accept, that we don't see accurately. We see according to our minds, to our own consciousness. So they saw they heard two kinds of birds and saw their own consciousness in the activities of those birds, and now they're going to hear, because they're in Dwarka, which is just by the ocean. They say, dear ocean, you're always roaring. You don't sleep at night. Are you too suffering from insomnia? Or is it that you, as with us, Mukunda has taken your insignias and you are hopeless of retrieving them? Insignias. Let's see what is meant by that. Purport. Srila Shuddha Swami states that Lord Krishna's queens here confused the sea surrounding Dwarka with the celestial, heavenly ocean of milk from which Lakshmi and the Kasturba gem arose long ago. These were taken by Lord Vishnu and they now reside on his chest. Mm-hmm. The queens presume that the ocean is anxious to see once again the mark of Lakshmi's residence and the Kasturba jewel on the Lord's chest. And they express their sympathy by saying that they also want to see these marks. But the queens desire even more to see the kumkum marks on the Lord's chest, which he took from their breasts when they last embraced him. My dear moon, so the ocean, the moon, the Karari bird, and the Chakravarti bird. My dear moon, having contracted a severe case of tuberculosis, you have become so emaciated that you failed to dispel the darkness with your rays. So this is, you know, the thin moon. They're saying this must be the problem. You are diseased. Or is it that you appear dumbstruck because, like us, you cannot remember the encouraging promise Mukunda once made to you? O Malayan breeze, what have we done to displease you so that you stir up lust within our hearts, which have already been shattered by Govinda's sidelong glance? O revered cloud, you are indeed very dear to the chief of the Yadavas, who bears the mark of Srivatsa. Like us, you are bound to him by love and are meditating upon him. Your heart is distraught with great eagerness, as our hearts are, and as you remember him again and again and shed torrents of tears, associating with Lord Krishna brings such misery. So the clouds, the breezes, the sweet breezes, the ocean, the crying of the birds at night, they're reminding the queens of Krishna, and even though he's with them, they are missing him so dearly. Stavaram jagamam deki na deki taramurti Savatra Hoya Nishta, Ishta Deva Sputi. That they're seeing everything as in relationship to their loving sentiment with Krishna. Just like a person who's very monetarily inclined, he's just thinking about how to get money. Whatever he sees, whether he sees flowers or the park or computers or cars, he's just thinking about how to turn it into money, because this is his own bhava, this is his own mood. So
he's imposing his mood. So the moods of the queens and the moods of the lovers of Krishna, they're seeing everything in relationship to Krishna and their own particular mood. Purport. The Acharyas, so this is about the cloud. The Acharyas explain this verse as follows. The cloud acts as the friend of Lord Krishna by shielding him from the scorching rays of the sun. And certainly such an earnest well-wisher of the Lord must constantly meditate on him with concern for his welfare. Although the cloud shares the Lord's blue complexion, it is Lord Krishna's distinctive features, such as his Srivatsma, that especially attract him, the cloud, to this meditation. But what is the result? Simply unhappiness. The cloud is depressed and thus constantly sheds tears on the pretext of raining. So the queens advise him, it would be better for you not to take much interest in Krishna, because they're crying. Oh, sweet-throated cuckoos. What sound does a cuckoo bird make? It doesn't make the sound of a cuckoo clock, which is cuckoo, cuckoo. In Vrindavan, there are certain seasons that the cuckoos make their sound. Coil. That's what it's called. Coil. In Hindi? Coil. You know the sound of coil? It's the fifth note. Something cool. Something like that. Not quite. And it's interesting that they have the notes of the scale. They're compared to each of the different animals and birds and their cries. So I think it's the fifth note of the scale. This is the note that the cuckoo hits. Coil. Oh, sweet-throated cuckoo, in a voice that could revive the dead, you are vibrating the same sounds we once heard from our beloved, the most pleasing of speakers. Please tell me, what can I do today to please you? Purport. As Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur explains, though the song of a cuckoo is very pleasant, Lord Krishna's wives perceive it as painful because it reminds them of their beloved Krishna and increases their pain of separation. Because the bird's voice is sweet, it reminds them of the sound of Krishna's voice, which is so sweet. And therefore, when they hear something that reminds them of Krishna and he's not there, they go into the ecstasy of viraha bhav. And because he is there and they're still missing him because he's right there resting, this is called a particular type of ecstasy that they're experiencing, a type of anuraga, which stays fairly close to mahabhava, called prema vaichitya. There's more too. So there's the cloud, cuckoo, Chakravarti, Kurari, the ocean, and now the mountains. Oh, magnanimous mountain, you neither move nor speak. You must be thinking some matter of great importance, thinking about something, pondering some matter of great importance. Or do you, like us, desire to hold on your breast the feet of Vasudeva's darling son? O rivers, wives of the oceans, your pools have now dried up. Alas, you have shriveled to nothing and your wealth of lotuses has vanished. Are you then like us who are withering away because of not receiving the affectionate glance of our dear husband, the Lord of Madhu, who has cheated our hearts? Purport. During the summer, the rivers do not receive downpours of water provided by their husband, the ocean, via the clouds. But the real reason for the rivers' emaciation, their thinness, as the queens see it, is that they have failed to obtain the loving glance of Lord Krishna, the reservoir of all happiness. And now, There is hunks. Hunksa means? Uh-huh. Hunks. Like Lufthansa. Means what?
Swan.
How do you say Ifrit? How do you say swan?
Balbu.
Balbu. Mm, good one. Oh, swan. Welcome, swan. Please sit here. We are in. This is swan. Yes? West as swan. Because there is one river. As swan river. Very close. Welcome, swan. There's swans?
Yeah.
Black ones, yeah. Welcome, swan. Please sit here and drink some milk. Give us some news of the descendant of Sura, new one. We know you're his messenger. Is that invincible lord doing well? And does that unreliable friend of ours still remember the words he spoke to us long ago? Why should we go and worship him? O servant of a petty master, go tell him. Go tell him who fulfills our desires to come here without the goddess of fortune. Is she the only woman exclusively devoted to him? So they've actually gone mad in their love. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. This is the last verse of this, and again, these were very much relished by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who was in the mood, specifically in the mood of relishing separation from Krishna. So this is a conversation that fills up the meaning of this that Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has described and is related here. So they're seeing a swan or hearing a swan. They must be seeing the swan. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur relates the following conversation between the queens and the swan. The queens ask, "Is the unconquerable Lord doing well?" The swan replies, "How can Lord Krishna be doing well without you, his beloved consorts? But does he even remember what he once told one of us, Srimati Rukmini? Does he recall that he said, 'In all my palaces, I see no other wife as dear as you'?" So that's from the 60th chapter. Krishna says that. Swan says, "He does indeed remember this, and that is just why he sent me here. We should all go to him and engage in his devotional service. Why should we go worship him if he refuses to come here to be with us? But my dear oceans of compassion, he is suffering so much from your absence. How can he be saved from this distress? Just listen, O servant of a petty master. Tell him to come here, as he should. If he is suffering from desires, he is only himself to blame, since he himself is the creator of Cupid's power. We self-respecting ladies are not going to yield to his demand that we should go seek him out. So be it. Then I will take my leave." "No, no, 1 minute, dear swan. Ask him to come to us here, but without the goddess of fortune, who always cheats us by keeping him all to herself. Don't you know that the goddess Lakshmi is devoted exclusively to the Lord? How could he give her up like that? And is she the only woman in the world who is completely sold out to him? What about us?" So this is the verse, but expanded out in the form of a conversation. Here's the verse, I'll read it again, so you see how it's just expanded the conversation. "Welcome, swan. Please sit here and drink some milk. Give us some news of the descendant of Sura, dear one. We know you are his messenger. Is that invincible lord doing well? And does that unreliable friend of ours still remember the words he spoke to us long ago? Why should we go and worship him? O servant of a petty master, go tell him who fulfills our desires to come here, but without the goddess of fortune. Is she the only woman exclusively devoted to him?" So this is at the end of the 10th canto. The end of the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam. After hearing about the Supreme Lord's position, about his dealing in Braja, with his parents, with his friends, with his girlfriends, the gopis, and all the residents of Braja. And then after hearing how he is unlimitedly powerful and at the age of 3 months kills Putana, at the age of 1 year he kills Trinavarta, and at the age of 6 or 7 he lifts a whole hill with a little finger of his left hand, and how he kills the bull demon Aristasura, and how he kills the Keshi demon in Vyomasura, and he does so many incredible pastimes displaying some of his potency, and then him going to Mathura and killing Kamsa and fighting with the huge wrestlers, and he's just a little boy, delicate and tender, and he fights with the wrestlers, and just practically speaking, with one punch he kills Chanura, and even before that a huge elephant he killed, and then he took out the tusk and stabbed him, the elephant, with the tusk of the elephant, and then he walked into the arena with the tusk over his shoulder, sprinkled with perspiration, looking unlimitedly beautiful and captivating everyone's mind and heart. And then after killing Kamsa, by assuming, because Kamsa went mad after Krishna and Balaram killed all the wrestlers, he went mad, and he called for the guards to capture Krishna and to throw Nanda Maharaj out of town and kill Vasudev and kill Ugrasena. He went mad, and no one, and crying out all these things, but no one would listen to him anymore. And then Krishna became angry at Kamsa and jumped up on the stage, on the what's that called again? The stage where he was sitting, the podium or whatever. And then he threw him down into the ground and then simply jumped on top of him. And he assumed the weight of the universe and killed him without anything, without doing anything. And then he dragged Kamsa around the arena like a lion would drag an elephant, because everyone was so afraid of Kamsa. There's one, I heard Radha Govinda Maharaj say that it's like when in the village in the old days, when there was a qazi in charge of the village, a Muslim magistrate, and he was a very heavy man, everyone was afraid. And then when the qazi's dog died, the qazi felt so bad, and he had a funeral for the dog, and the whole village turned out for the funeral. But then the qazi died, and no one went to the funeral because they weren't afraid of him anymore. They only went to the dog's funeral because they were afraid of the qazi. So when Krishna dragged Kamsa around, and Kamsa was so powerful, he was a powerful demon who had taken his birth to give trouble to the earth and the demigods, and Krishna just killed him without even hitting him. And Kamsa was terrified continuously of Krishna. And then Krishna went to school. He learned all the arts in 64 days and 64 days. And he came from school and he recovered the debts. So he did all these incredible things. He went back to Mathura. He fought with Jarasandha and defeated him 17 times. And then he freed the kings and killed, liberated Mukchakunda from his sleeping, and which was a funny pastime. It's funny because after Mukchakunda came out of the cave, because he was from a different yuga, he was huge, and everyone else was so small. And he wanted to be with Krishna all the time because he was a devotee. And Krishna thought, how am I going to this big fellow always following me around? Because he had to kill all the demons. And every time there would be a demon for Krishna to kill, Mukchakunda would have to step forward and you know, and it would be very awkward. So Krishna told him to go to the Himalayas and meditate. He said, in next life you can become a Brahmin in that way. Well, you go. You go to the mountains, Himalayas, and meditate. So after hearing all these pastimes of Krishna, including killing of Sisupal and everyone watching the soul from Sisupal's body merging with Krishna, and the whole battle of Kurukshetra, and now this kind of a pastime to sum up what's going on, what's happened, the highest level of love for Krishna. So at this point, we're not supposed to mistake this as something ordinary. But because even though our only frame of reference is between the dealing of males and females in this world is ordinary, but still we should know that this is extraordinary. This is beyond the ordinary. This is about Krishna and his dealings with his internal energy, practically speaking. Sukadev Goswami said, thus, by speaking and acting with such ecstatic love for Lord Krishna, the master of all masters of mystic yoga. So he's the master of all masters of mystic yogas. So the masters of mystic yoga, like the experts in yoga, they can do amazing things. They can become huge, they can become light, they can become small, they can, you know, prapti siddhi, they can touch anything and bring it to where they are. So Krishna is the master of all masters of mystic yoga. So by speaking and acting with such ecstatic love for Lord Krishna, the master of all masters of mystic yoga, his loving wives attain the ultimate goal of life because they missed Krishna continuously. They, even in Krishna's association, felt separation from him, and we, unfortunately, without Krishna's association, are quite satisfied or unsatisfied at some level, truly, but we don't miss him. So this is the purpose, or one of the purposes of hearing about Krishna, is to learn how to miss Krishna, to understand what the missing part of our life actually is. So we'll continue this probably tomorrow. We'll finish. Maybe this chance we'll finish tomorrow. Not tomorrow, but on Monday. Anyway, those verses that we read were very dear to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Thank you. Any questions or comments? Just like that song. Yeah. How we played. I'm missing you, Krishna. Vatulu. I hear the sound of your flute. So cute and so simple. And Prabhupada said, this is how to practice the devotional service, missing Krishna. But how do you miss Krishna when you don't know him that well? Well, we have to learn how to know him by hearing about him. Rukmini Devi, just like in this picture, she got to know Krishna just by hearing about him. Who did she hear from? Before that, she was already married to him. Before she was married. No, yes. Any questions or comments?
Is this the end of the Bhagavatam then?
No. We're getting to the end of the 10th canto.
Oh.
And after the end of the 10th canto, there's the 11th canto. And after the 11th, there's
the 12th.
What's
the
difference between the Krishna book and the 10th canto?
Well, there's only 89 chapters in the Krishna book.
But
it's a summary study of the 10th canto. Prabhupada translated it with any, because he describes this in Chaitanya Charitamrita, because he was already, he wrote the Krishna book in perhaps 1970. So he was already over 70 years old and he had started the Krishna conscious movement. But no one knew anything about Krishna. No one knew anything about Krishna, practically speaking. Before we started chanting, no one even saw a picture of Krishna. So, even though it was the 10th canto of the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada was at that time probably translating the third canto, probably. So he wanted to make sure we would know something about Krishna. So before he got up to the 10th canto, in a order of going 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, he decided to write the Krishna book, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, which is a summary of it, of the 10th canto.
Even though that he recommends not to read the 10th canto before the rest.
Yeah, but because he wrote the Krishna book in such a way that the purports and all the philosophy is interwoven in there. Because when Prabhupada writes in such a definitive way that you can't mistake, you know, like when I was trying to say that it's not ordinary. And so Prabhupada weaves that type of philosophy in all the pastimes so we can't mistake Krishna's activities as ordinary. Yes, so even though we should go through the Bhagavatam in an order from one to from the beginning to the end, but still the Krishna book is there. And we were amazed when we read Krishna book because it was all completely new to us. Question or comment?
How do we understand that this final chapter, which is in summary, opens with this particular setting of the Queen's Talk? Remember that.
Better answer that at the end and see how it summarizes. Asking how's this chapter a summary of the Lord Krishna's pastimes? There's another famous. You can't come halfway through and then ask that. You're not allowed. Because this is the last chapter, we started in the beginning. And yesterday, we had three
morning. Three morning was the chapter before the last one.
Doesn't seem like much of a summary.
Yes, it was wondering.
But in some sense it must be.
This conversation between the swan and the queen. Like for some time the people go into a deep mood of understanding that that's how queens are deeply in love with Krishna. But like so while hearing, we are in that mood of understanding, but that mood goes straight away when you are away from the class. So like how to maintain that mood?
Naturally, yes. Has to be naturally, of course, by the process of hearing over time. This is what we want. So it has to come naturally and generally, gradually. And very important is the process of increasing the hearing and chanting. I was reading some words of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He said, we should start chanting, say, 16 rounds or something, and then work our way to 64 rounds, and then gradually increase from there until they're chanting 192 rounds a day. And the taste is so strong. So we can see that. But he recommended that. But that was 100 years ago. And now people can't. Maybe not even 100. But now people can't do that either. So we have to gradually move forward. And the idea, though, is at least by the end of one's life, one should be fully immersed in hearing and chanting about Krishna. And then obviously if one has the capacity to do that, to always hear and chant about Krishna, which is a gradual cultivation, because one's more and more attached to the sweetness, to that sweetness, that taste, then we'll be carrying that mood with us. We shouldn't be pretentious. Shouldn't pretend. We should be natural according to our actual situation. So we can look how unfortunate it is that we hear something in the Bhagavatam, and our mood is one thing, and then we leave, and then we lose that. So we can see how unfortunate that we lose it. And then we could also see how fortunate it is that I got a little bit of a taste. We just want that taste to grow. So when it is mature, then it will capture, means our absorption in the Gita Krishna is complete. And then, you know, 24 hours a day. That's one way to look at it. Another way is that we have our other services to do. So we don't have exactly this mood for the rest of the day, but we should try to keep the mood as much as we can that the other things that we do are also service. And we should see how they're all service, everything we do, and stay always in the mood of a servant. So the question is how to become very, very sincere.
How to become selfless?
Yeah, sincere. But the way I look at it is, either we become selfless and sincere, or humble. So if we can't be selfless and sincere, we should be humble. And that's just as good in one sense. So to recognize our selfishness and insincerity is also very valuable.
If we can't become selfless and sincere, so how can we become truly humble?
By being aware of how selfish and insincere we are. Either way, you're okay. But part of humility is to to depend on Krishna, not just to become, realize you're selfish and insincere and then neurotic and crazy. Just all day long think, oh, I'm the most selfish and insincere, and oh, I'm this and I'm that and I'm this, and all day long, and I want to be this, and I. But I don't think, oh, Krishna, I mean, how can I serve you to the best of my limited ability? Especially helping others. Dhruv. Dhruv is still awake? You okay?